and welcome to edition 276 of the NRF1 podcast, because Norfolk knows Formula 1. This is your F1 podcast straight out of Norfolk, UK. We are recording remotely from our homes once again, because even though we can meet up outside, it's a bit cold, so we're staying warm, so please forgive us for that. But we're here, as usual, to bring you the latest from the world of Formula 1, along with our review of the Bahrain Grand Prix and the preview to the upcoming Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix, which I'll tell you now, we're just going to call it Imola, okay? I am Richard Baxter, hosting once again, and with me tonight we have Norfolk's next top F1 engineer, Callum's brother, Dan Springle, is here.
Hello. Well, maybe we might have to drop the Formula 1, because, I'm moving into Formula E now, so exciting times.
Definitely, really is exciting. It just goes to show that we do have some really top talent here on the podcast, mainly looking at you, Dan, to be honest. not me. but really, really good luck with that. We're all really excited, and I'm sure our listeners are hyped as well. And it just means you're going to have plenty more to bring us and much more to say, right?
No, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Fantastic, fantastic. And also we have, I should also say, the immensely talented, the F1 fan with the wizard beard, Phil Gray, is here.
Evening. I literally have no talent at all whatsoever, so I'll let Dan take all the F1 talent, that's fine. Evening, guys.
You been all right? You been good?
Yeah, cracking. Yeah, really good. It's good to see the racing back on the telly, getting into more proper race weekends with people actually in the stands. Wow, what a weird world that is.
Yeah, it seems very strange. I mean, obviously in the UK we're just kind of at the next stage of lockdown easing, and we're already seeing stands in the fans. Like, oh, I said that the wrong way around. Fans in the stands. Wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, so
hopefully we'll see more full ones in the not too distant future, and this horrific year of people not being able to go out and do what we want to do is going to be a distant memory shortly.
Oh, I hope so. Hope so. Right. We better crack on, because we've got lots to get through. But first of all, we need to mention, because I don't think we did mention it on our last podcast, because I think it was announced shortly afterwards. But obviously, the passing of Murray Walker, it was really sad for everyone. I think Williams had on their car a really nice tribute to Murray as well. But it's sad to see him go. It would have been nice to hear him talk about this race, because, I mean, Bahrain, we had a fantastic race, really, didn't we?
Yeah, it was a great race, and it was definitely one that I'm sure Murray would have enjoyed. You know, it was his voice and commentary will resonate with the majority of people that have ever watched the sport previously, because. Or any forms of motorsport, because he wasn't exclusively Formula One, but his voice and passion really came through to it, and I think that really elevated up what a race commentator can bring to the sport, not just someone telling you what's happening on track, but occasionally poking a driver in the forehead where he's hurt himself.
Oh yeah, that's a classic one.
Yeah, definitely. But it was a great race, and yeah, everything that you want in an opening race, apart from it's not in Australia.
Yeah, that's true. Which we should also mention, obviously, you mentioned, say, Australia, they're having some track changes, so look forward to seeing what that has to bring in November, I think it is now. Hopefully it will make overtaking a bit easier there, because often can be difficult. But back to Bahrain, like we say, it was a cracking race. I think it's fair to say that we want more of the same. And I mean, it all really started before the race, because obviously the formation lap, Sergio Perez, who didn't have the easiest of qualifyings, I think he was 11th or so, he had a kind of semi-breakdown on the formation lap, didn't he?
Yeah. It's the curse of the second seat at Red Bull.
Yeah.
like I said in the chat, I don't know whether it's the second seat thing at Red Bull is so difficult to crack because Max is that much naturally better than everybody else and just completely driving the wheels off the car, and where Sergio Perez is with the car is where the actual car would be, and then it's really difficult to make that comparison when, but your teammate is your only comparison in racing. So it could just be a tough deal with having potentially one of the greatest drivers learning his trade in it.
Well, I think we also have to add in here that Red Bull have kind of got history, haven't they? If you think back to when Vettel was at the team and they paired him with Webber, they pretty much just revolved the entire team around Sebastian, didn't they? So they seem to sort of heavily favour one driver over the other, almost to the detriment of, well, you could say the entire team, really. So, yeah, it's definitely a second cursed seat, but I think that's of their own doing, really. They need to look in the mirror.
Mm. That's a very good point. But I mean, we should say, to be fair to Perez as well, he did have a really good comeback drive to fifth place, I think it was, in the end.
Yeah, he got driver of the day, as voted for by the fans on Sky. So I think that speaks volumes of that. Which I think it's the second time he got driver of the day at that track. So he got it for Force India, didn't he?
Yeah, was it last year?
Yeah, it was last year. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Checo is making quite a reputation for himself in that sense, isn't it? Because as much as I like Alex and Pierre, they haven't been able to master that skill of coming back through a field when they quite clearly have a car that's on song. And I think that just shows the experience that Perez has now. I mean, if you compare him to the driver he was at McLaren in 2013 to now, he's come on so many leaps and bounds, it's almost unbelievable, really.
Yeah, that McLaren step for him was probably a season or two seasons early for him to be into a top team, and then also filling the seat of Lewis Hamilton to then get into a team that's starts to struggle a bit more financially. It's, you know, there wasn't much going for him at the time, and I think he needed a lot more help than would have been afforded to him.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. Well, it'd be interesting to see what he can do for the rest of the season, for sure. And then, now this is a bit of a difficult one, because we need to go to Haas, because going through the race, they obviously had a lot going for them. Talk about young drivers, Haas have two of them. Everyone knows Mazepin and Schumacher. Now, it was literally the third corner on the first lap, and Nikita Mazepin loses it into the wall and he's out of the race. Now, this guy has not had the easiest of starts in Formula One for several reasons. He's obviously, you know, he's got a lot to do to make Formula One fans see him as a worthwhile person for that seat, as a worthwhile driver for that seat, and that was not the ideal situation for him at all, was it?
No, really, far from it, to be quite honest with you. The fact that he's kind of now been nicknamed Mazespin has not really worked for him, and also my brother also called him he shall not be named in the last podcast. I think probably tells you about as much as you really need to know about him, but yeah, I think that was perhaps one of the shortest debut races that has been in Formula One record. So, yeah, not the best start, but equally, we also saw Mick dropping it after the safety car restart. So, it almost looks like that Haas isn't particularly great to drive. Looks to be a little bit skittish, so be interesting to see how those two cope with that during the year and whether they can remedy something for next year, because I mean this year is just going to be a filler and something that they can learn about their own processes to get next year right. So yeah, see how that goes.
Yeah, definitely. And Phil, your take on it. I know you're never short of an opinion.
Yeah, I think I genuinely hope that both of those drivers are looking at this year as, let's just actually learn how to drive a Formula One car, because it is obviously different to anything else, and to get that experience. That a lot of young drivers do go down that route of trying to get into a smaller team, learn the trade a little bit more, then go on to a bigger team. You know, like obviously to a lesser extent, George Russell's at Williams still learning his trade and his craft a bit there, to then get into the big seat at the Mercs. But with Mazepan, he's got a long way to go to endear himself to people. I'm not a massive fan of paid drivers. I've said this before, and you know him. He's another Lance Stroll in that kind of world. But the car looks like it's particularly difficult, and with you chucking a couple of inexperienced drivers, it's, you know, they're never going to get a happy ending on the first race on that. So hopefully they learn from it, and more specifically Mick, because obviously it's nice to see the Schumacher name back in the sport, even though I am, at the time, I was a massive Damon Hill fan and didn't particularly like the style for Michael Schumacher. But obviously looking back at him, he's, you know, one of those drivers you have to enjoy when you can watch him.
Definitely, I totally agree with that sentiment. I know exactly how you feel with that.
Yeah.
Still won't forget Adelaide in 94.
No, so. No, you can't. But hey, that's part of the sport, isn't it? You know, Senna done it, and everyone thought he was brilliant for it. So
yeah,
it's just his personalities, and a lot of it's how the media depict you. But you know, I think seeing the Schumacher name back in the sport is great, and obviously they've got Fittipaldi as the reserve driver there as well, which is obviously another great name to have back in the sport. But the thing to be said about them, I don't think either of them are in the sport because of their name. I think it's obviously it'll help them, but I think they've both done their time in the lower formulas and in working their way up properly. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they've just had the door open to him and go, oh, you're Michael's son or you're Emo's nephew, you can come straight in and get a seat. But I think they've had to work for it, which means that they're trying to build their own name, not just live off their family. So which is a testament to them, I think, really.
Yeah, very true.
Well,
very
up
true.
Until fairly recently, actually. Well, I say fairly recently, until Mick was in European F3, he was using his mother's maiden name. To kind of, I guess, take away some of the pressure of who his dad is. But he's not necessarily had a meteoric rise as such, a little bit like our George. he has sort of had a bit of a, let's say, a slower rise through the ranks. He kind of takes 1 year to settle himself and find out how to drive that machinery quickly. Guess you could say like a sort of finding his feet year, and then the second year he just goes all out, and I think that's kind of been not only proved when he won European F3 in 2018, or was it 2018? I can't remember, but he definitely won it in the last sort of couple of years, and even in F2 he's really sort of taken that and gone on strongly. So yeah, I think the fact that he's got a year sort of without so much pressure, just being at the back and I think perhaps take some of the limelight off him is going to work in his favour.
Mm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds for him, and hopefully Mick can really step it up next season, and we'll have the car to show us and show everyone what he's got. Now, we need to get onto the big talking points from the race. For me, this race was a brilliant race, but it was really actually helped by the build-up that we had. You know, there's the phrase of you can watch the storm brewing. And to me, it felt like that. We were watching this race unfold, and you had Hamilton and Verstappen, who it was clearly going to be one of those who's going to take the victory. And you could see this battle building up throughout the race, different tactics taken by each of their teams. That was all unfolding, and in the end we had probably the last five laps quite a fantastic battle on track, which really decided it all. Now we need to mention the dreaded track limits, because obviously the overtake that never was, I guess you can say, where that Verstappen did, where he ran wide, obviously had to let Hamilton back through. At the time, I thought, yes, very fair. Fair to him, fair racing, fair from Red Bull as well. FIA obviously told him to do it. Now, guys, I want your take on it. So, Dan, I'll let you you jump in first. What was your whole take on the battle, and do you think that was the right decision?
So, I guess let's start with the track limits then. So, I kind of found it quite interesting that the FIA decided that Hamilton could quite easily run wide and gain a lasting advantage for basically half the race. But they weren't calling that a lasting advantage, despite the fact that if he had gained maybe a hundredth of a second every time he did it, then half the race has gone by, and all of a sudden that's a couple of seconds potentially. So, yeah, it's kind of... well, track limits has always been a kind of bane debate of the sport, and this has kind of thrown it even more into a little bit of disrepute. So I think this kind of sparked some renewed debate and calls to the FIA to be more consistent on the track limits, and rightly so, because we've kind of now run into the position where we're just talking about track limits as opposed to the great racing that we had. So, rightly so, Verstappen gave the position back, and even whilst I was watching it, I thought he's going to have to give that back, and almost to my sort of shock, he kind of did it in one of the worst places possible. So, if he'd done it a little bit more thoughtfully, he could have quite easily been back in the lead, perhaps half a lap later, but yeah, perhaps... a little bit of a brain fart, let's say, from Verstappen and Red Bull on that one. If they'd have considered that properly, then we probably would have been talking about a different race winner here. But yeah, the sort of whole race build up to it was intriguing. There were plenty of opportunities for strategic mistakes, and there were a number of times where I thought, oh, Red Bull have made a mistake there, and then, you know, half a race later and, oh, Mercedes definitely made this mistake, so who's going to come out on top? And then, yeah, we were left with that sort of last 5/10 lapse at the end. So if we end up with some more racing like this, then I'm certainly not going to complain.
Definitely. What about you, Phil? What was your take on the whole situation?
I mean, what a great race. I mean, it was the amount of different strategy calls that were being made throughout the race, and it was completely swinging what was happening on track almost instantly. It was almost back to the days of refueling the car and that sort of level of sort of strategy, how heavy is the car and stuff like that at this point. And it was really exciting to see, and you know, Red Bull during their absolute pomp when Sebastian was there, they just wouldn't make mistakes on the strategy call. Absolutely everything would be spot on. They did make mistakes, which ultimately probably is why Max didn't end up being on the first step of the race. I mean, the track limits thing, it's, I think what people don't particularly like about it, it's not rules is rules, this is the rule. This is the rule, but will it take it under a different interpretation each time? So they'll be doing it through testing, through quali, and then I'll check. There's been times in the past where they've then changed the definition of a corner, of what, where they find the acceptable amount of track limits in one particular spot, and then really enforce that throughout the race, which can ruin the race occasionally. So it definitely, I think, needs to have a bit more clarification for the stewards, if more than anybody else, just so they know, okay, right, so if this is a serious point where by a car exceeding the track limits here, they are actually gaining a lasting advantage. Every single time a car exceeds that spot, that's fine. You know, give the warnings at that point throughout the race. Don't let it go for three quarters of the race, and then suddenly when we've got two drivers that are driving on hardly any tyres, fighting away like no one's business, and you know, one does exceed the track limits, to then really come down hard at that point, that's where the frustration comes from supporters, I think. I mean, obviously he did go outside the track limits, he had to give the back place, but I think if you look back at the team radio, and you can see the reason why they had that brain fart, we'll call it, to give it back, give the place back in the wrong spot. Max was having an argument with his engineer to say, no, if I'm going to get a penalty, I'll just make sure I'm 5 seconds ahead of him at the end of the race, because it'll be a 5 second penalty. And there was a little conflict between him and the engineer to say, no, you've got to give the place back. And at that point, he obviously clearly just thought, I'll get it done now. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to drop a bomb.
you're fine, don't worry.
And we'll get it done now. And you know, that's, I think that came out of more frustration. And going back to Red Bull under Sebastian, that sort of thing wouldn't happen. There wouldn't be that level of frustration in the car. They'd be a lot cooler and more collected over it.
No, that's a very good point. Now, also talking about this, Sam Todd, who you must be one of our top listeners, Sam, to be honest. You're always on social media giving your thoughts and ideas and discussion points and everything. Now, you sent us a couple of tweets. We're going to address them now quickly. We're going to go to the second one first. And it was basically a video clip of an onboard with Tsunoda during the race, who we haven't even mentioned yet, but also had a good race. But it was basically, Sam says, thoughts on this pass from Ocon on Tsunoda. Seems to be no issue with track limits with the stewards, as far as I'm aware. Now, for those of you who want to see it, I think it's on the best onboards video from the weekend on YouTube for Formula One. But basically, Ocon, Tsunoda running side by side. They got up to turn four. Ocon was on the outside. He ran wide off the circuit onto that runoff area and maintained the position and got past. Now, that wasn't an issue, but obviously the Hamilton Verstappen one was. There was talks of how, like you mentioned, Phil, the track limits changed during the race. Do you think that move maybe was the marker where the FIA, the stewards, saw it and said, no, we need to do something? Or do you think that was just missed by the stewards?
I think I was just missed completely. I think there was an awful lot going on throughout the whole race. I don't know. I haven't seen the different notifications that the stewards get, but obviously the tech on the car, as far as their positioning is concerned, is, it is very complex. So you'd assume that if there was going to be a hard and fast rule on track limits, when a car's sensor goes over a certain distance away from the track limit, which they'll know through GPRS, you'd think that would flag into the stewards so they don't miss it. But then, there's a lot of stewards. They should be able to cover the whole race, but I do just generally think that was missed by them. And obviously, there was a lot more eyes on Max and Lewis at the time, and so they obviously made the call because all of them were watching it.
Yeah, true.
So you mentioned the sort of technology there, Phil. So in club racing, in particular at Brands Hatch at Paddock Hill, they have some pressure sensors on the outside of the corner. And if you go over the curb to the point where you then trigger the pressure sensor, you get taken a picture of you, and you'll then get reported to the stewards. So if you can do it in club racing, then why can't you do it in Formula One? But you also have to, whilst we're here, we also have to mention that GT racing is very consistent. At the very least, it is always all four wheels must be on the correct side of the white line. And in the race director's notes, if it's any different, then it may be on the curb. So we can do it in other categories. Why not Formula One?
Yeah, true. And I think Martin Brundle in the commentary was saying as well, if you're going to run wide there, you're redefining the corner itself. So you might as well just change the track layout if you're going to let them do that.
Yeah, it also impacts on the safety as well, because the safety of the circuit, like the barrier design and safer barriers, what have you, have all been designed for that corner geometry.
Mm. It's a very good point, something you don't always think about, actually, but yeah, that's very true. Yeah. And we'll move on to Sam's next point, but yeah. is the first comment he said was, great race, thoroughly enjoyed. Something that left me frustrated, though, was the way Mercedes handled Bottas's strategy. Now, for me, what I found frustrating was the way Bottas handled Bottas's strategy.
Yeah, it's all on him, really, isn't it?
It was... I don't want to be horrible to the guy, because Bottas comes across as a really nice guy, and I think you could have a good laugh with him, and I think he's a quick driver who's just in Hamilton's shadow quite a lot, and made to look quite average from it. But that race, he had his engineer, I think Toto was there, I think it was James Vowles, isn't it, who was there as well, and they're all saying, right, come on, Valtteri, you know. You can do this. You're still in with a sight of winning this race. And they're really encouraging him. But he never seemed to have a response to anything.
Yeah, he just wasn't quick enough on the day. It's simple as that, really, isn't it? If you're going to be sort of in the strategy game, you need to have the pace to back it up with, which is one of Hamilton's sort of key strengths. But also, you could also say Verstappen as well. So he's kind of taken himself out of the game there. And even when they did try and swap up the strategies, it kind of didn't really work for them, because then they kind of got sort of put into a corner by their own rules of engagement. So, yeah, I guess I can see the point that Mercedes have kind of not really helped him, but equally the driver needs to back it up with the pace to even be in on the strategy game. So, yeah, it's kind of swings and roundabouts.
And just looking at the race timings... He came in for a late pit stop and obviously got the fastest lap of the race, and got the extra bonus point because third was safe for him. But he finished 37 seconds behind the leaders. Now, 25 seconds for a pit stop. You've still got another 12 seconds there that he was behind them, and that's quite far to be behind, you know, your teammate and the other guy who's battling for the win.
Yeah, especially when you're arguably in one of the quickest cars on the track. The Mercs for years have dominated. Obviously, Red Bull appear to have come with a good strong challenge. But for the domination that the Mercedes have had, you'd expect day one for them to still be somewhere within touching distance, especially when you're taken to... Yeah, if you're... You listen to the theory that Valtteri does the majority of the testing in the sim and stuff like that. You'd think he'd have a better understanding of the car than Lewis if that were actually the case. But you just don't see that result. You see a driver who has obviously got talent. He's demonstrated that over and over and over again. Go through the same cycle every single season. He'll come into the first race of the season, you know, talking really positive and being like that. He'll probably still be relatively positive for the second race. You'll think, oh, Lewis got that one, I'll get this race. But then he'll go into the second driver mode where he's very grumpy for a few races, and then he'll have a decent result and kick back into being positive again. I think what would be best for Valtteri, for his career, is if he actually left the Mercs to get out of Lewis's shadow, because he doesn't seem to be able to compete with him. Go and be a number one driver at the third best team, because he won't get into Red Bull because they're a young driver program. Well, I haven't said that, they've just signed Perez, haven't they? But he needs something new to kick on and be able to lead on, because he's got the skill set to be a number one driver, I'm sure of it. But I think he's in a car he's in a car that he can't outdrive, which he needs to be able to do.
Mm. No. Well, we also have to consider that what happened in Sakhir last year with George.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily believe that he would become a number one driver. I think de facto he would probably be the number one driver if in the theoretical scenario if Hamilton retired, he would be the number one to begin with, but I have a feeling George would quickly sort of stake a claim to that, a little bit like what happened with Charles and Sebastian at Ferrari.
Yeah, that's true.
In all honesty, I was a little bit disappointed that George wasn't in the car this year in the Merc, because I thought from last season, I thought he'd done enough in those races to demonstrate that he knew how to drive, get a good amount out of that car under difficult circumstances for him, driving in a seat that's too small for him, you know, knees around the steering wheel, and it's completely set up for somebody else who's a lot shorter than him. But still, to get that level of performance out of the car that he did, I thought was excellent. And obviously he will be in the Merc at some point soon, and he'll be fully deserved of it, but I do think it should have been this season.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see if Russell could do something better, but you never know. If Bottas doesn't step up and perform well, it could be a mid-season change. It wouldn't be you know, we've seen it before. So
there was another mid-season change rumoured around already this season, because Hülkenberg's gone in as the reserve driver at Aston Martin, isn't he?
Yeah.
Today, and I've seen people on social media saying, "Oh, is this the end for Seb already?" Obviously, he'd had a difficult weekend, which it just looked like the same Sebastian, just in a different colour overall from the past two years, which is a shame, because the more competitive drivers we have, the best racing we're gonna end up watching. But I can't ever envision that Seb won't finish the season. I think he's got far too much skill for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be surprised.
That really was quite a silly move, wasn't it? Let's be honest, on Ocon. I mean, he admitted it after the race that it was his mistake, and he went and apologised to Ocon. But still, you expect better than that from a full-time world champion, don't you?
Why did he have to move? He was literally driving in a straight line.
That's not quite as good as he's hit me in the effing rear and the effing front and all this.
Oh, yeah.
Michael used to do that very well.
Yeah, we might have to message him and get to do a recording of that to throw it back in there. But, yeah, classic. But no, you mentioned, obviously, Vettel and Ocon there, two of the teams who, I mean, we'd consider midfield teams, obviously Aston Martin and Alpine. There's other teams you're going to throw in there as well. The likes of McLaren, the AlphaTauri looked quick. Even Alfa Romeo seemed to have a big improvement. And obviously you've got the great Ferrari in there, who obviously kind of somewhere in the mix. Now, Dan, we're gonna cut away here to your pre-recording, because the whole grid is obviously so much closer this year than it was last year and in previous seasons. And it's great to see that, but you've recorded a little piece to kind of explain possibly some of the reasons why, and talking about how the rake of the cars, isn't it, and how that affects things.
Yeah, so we're kind of going to have a little monologue just to kind of get a flavour of what happens between high and low rake, and how you, as an engineer, try and combat the advantages and disadvantages of both concepts for your sort of overall vehicle performance. So hopefully this is a reasonably good explainer for the layman, and everyone can kind of come away from this with a little bit more knowledge about how a Formula One car is designed.
Fantastic. So you heard him then, and you'll hear him now. Here is Dan. Take it away.
Hello everyone, Dan here. Now, I want to give you perhaps a little bit of insight into the high and low rake concept debate and how these have effectively changed the balance of power between Mercedes and Red Bull. So, I guess without further ado, let's get straight into it. So, from a vehicle performance point of view, we have a few design targets. And these essentially are a balance between driver comfort and making the car as fast as it can possibly go. So we tend to want some high-speed understeer, and this is generally preferable to give the driver a lot of confidence. But
in the low and medium speed, we tend to move the balance more towards oversteer. Now, this just helps rotate the car for getting the traction down. We need that optimal drive out of the corner so we can improve our straight line acceleration. Now, we also have to understand how the balance of the car is influenced depending on, I guess, how quickly you can take the corner. So the high-speed balance is obviously dominated by the aerodynamic characteristics, but as the speed bleeds off the car, the mechanical elements, they then have an increasing influence. So these tend to be the anti-roll bars or the suspension geometry, the springs, the dampers. And these then effectively dictate how much power you can put down out of a corner, how the driver's going to respond to any behaviour on turn in, how the car is going to feel at the apex, and obviously then dictates the car's line and the car's speed. But not only do we have the balance, we also have effectively the curb riding ability of the car, because particularly at the moment in modern day F1, the track limit rules tend to change almost on a race by race basis. And I mean, you could also say in Bahrain that we had a mid-race change. So these track limit rules tend to then place more emphasis on mechanical compliance, which in the most simplest terms is essentially how the car responds to bumps, curbs, other disturbances. So we have to keep these things in mind when we are considering the advantages and the disadvantages of both concepts. So we do have a few characteristics that we have to be quite wary of. Now, the first one is the diffuser stalling, and this happens particularly when the rear ride height is too low, which causes a massive loss of downforce and also drag through effectively flow separation. And whilst this is good for straight line speed, it does shift the aerodynamic balance towards the front and therefore will cause severe oversteer. So I guess you could think of this like another DRS, essentially. And commonly, this starts stalling in the middle. So this is why all of the dividers and the flow separators that you may see in pictures of diffusers are used effectively to prevent the diffuser from stalling. Now, we've had a number of dividers and separators reduced for this year, not only in number, but also in length. And this is where McLaren's innovative loophole genius idea comes in. They basically have a couple of long central dividers, and this prevents some of the diffuser stalling on set and should help give them some more consistent downforce, but will also allow them to work the floor a little bit harder. So we also have the front wing stalling, and this is effectively the same as the diffuser stalling. It happens when the front wing is too close to the ground, so therefore we'll also lose downforce and drag. Now, you may remember when Mercedes had their double DRS, and that was the primary reason, was they would then stall the front wing and also pick up a bit more straight line speed. But that was also used to neutralise some of the balance shift. Now, we also have floor leakage, and this is happening when we have higher pressure air outside the underfloor area encroaching on the low pressure area. Now, this reduces the downforce, and effectively what the barge boards are trying to do is to seal off the floor, the underfloor, from the higher pressure area. So this is why these are so crucial for setting up some vortices that end up sealing the floor. So let's think back to the ground effects days when the teams had the sliding skirts. This is essentially just an invisible version of that. And lastly, we also have to consider the other sort of crucial area for aerodynamic design, and that is how much power the power unit can deliver for us. So if we have a more powerful power unit, then the aerodynamicists then have let's say a little bit more design freedom. They can design a car with higher downforce, and that will naturally also induce additional drag. But that will then achieve effectively the same top speeds, So let's say we have more drag, but the same amount more power. And we have the added benefit then of higher cornering speed, and therefore your lap time improves quite significantly. So let's talk about rake then. Let's define it. Now, rake is, simply put, the difference between the front and rear ride heights. And teams can often refer to it as a difference in length. So that may be in millimetres, for example. Or it could be an angle, if you take into account the wheelbase. Now, rake is very obvious from a side-on view. And if you had two pictures of the Mercedes and the Red Bull, you can clearly see the difference. So a low rake obviously then means that we have a small difference between the front and rear ride height, and high rake is a large difference. So obviously Mercedes is the low rake because it's a much flatter car, whereas the Red Bull is very high rake, almost to an extreme level. So let's consider some of the advantages and disadvantages of both. So we'll start with the low rake, and the main advantage is that it's just wholly a less aggressive setup. We tend to see various different types of behaviour. So the aerodynamic balance shift is considerably less. So therefore, the car is much more predictable for the driver throughout all stages of the corner, although let's assume that that is without any diffuser stalling, or that the flow has reattached if the diffuser has stalled. Now, we'd also see more consistent downforce throughout the lap. And from a design point of view, it can also be easier to seal the floor with a low rake solution. We also have a lower centre of gravity and more consistent mechanical balance due to the change in suspension travel being considerably less, because if we have the rear ride height quite low to begin with, then for the same amount of force, we need quite a stiff suspension to stop that from bottoming out. Now, let's consider the disadvantages. So it's less compliant across the bumps and the curbs because, as I mentioned, the rear suspension needs to be just that bit stiffer to prevent any touching. Now, that will play into your hands if you have a very smooth circuit. But we have a number of tracks this year that we need to be quite aggressive on the curbs. Imola, I think, is perhaps the first one we come to where this is a very prevalent problem. But we also have, obviously, Monaco and some of the other street tracks. And we have less peak downforce. So on the high rake, the main advantages are that we have a higher volume under the car. So it's easier to create more downforce, although that is provided that the floor is then sealed properly. The rear suspension in particular will also be softer, so we can abuse the curbs better. And the mechanical balance is then more towards oversteer, because the suspension members will effectively act like a spring, or in cornering, an anti-roll bar. So the internal components will need to be, or can be then, lighter, because they're not effectively taking as much load as they would be otherwise. And also, the front wing is then closer to the ground, especially at low speed, so we can then help use that to rotate the car. Now, the main disadvantages are that the rear suspension arms will then be heavier, because, as I mentioned, we need to beef them up, basically, so that they can carry that additional load. We also have a higher centre of gravity, so that will affect all corners, but particularly low and medium speed, so we'll have more load transfer. And also, all of the aerodynamic surfaces will then become a little bit more prone to stalling. And whilst obviously that is good for your straight line speed, in particularly windy conditions or anything that is producing conditions that you haven't designed for, or are essentially non-perfect, will tend to hurt you, particularly when you're very peaky. So let's conclude then. So the balance of power is obviously swung quite considerably between the two concepts, And with Honda's help, Red Bull and AlphaTauri seem to have made a good step forward relative to everyone else. And obviously then we've seen Mercedes lose considerable amount more time than Red Bull. And Aston Martin have fallen back relative to where they were last year. So it definitely appears that the low rake concept has lost more downforce relative to the high rake. But also, the advantages of the low rake concept doesn't seem to have outweighed the disadvantages of the high rake setup as they had done previously. So it'd be interesting to see when we go to a few different types of tracks, how that sort of balance of power is going to shift depending on the characteristics of the circuit. So this is all going to carry over into next year. It's going to be incredibly interesting to see how the new regulations are going to shift that balance of power either way. So any learning that any of the teams can do this year of the relative advantages and disadvantages of both concepts will ultimately end up benefiting their car design for next year. So it'll be interesting to see who comes out with what this time next year. So I think that wraps up our kind of, let's say, explainer or perhaps mini debate. So without further ado, I'll hand it back over to Rich.
That was Dan. Brilliant. Thanks for that, Dan. I'm sure everyone enjoyed it, and I mean, I had a listen to it and it made a lot of sense to me. So listeners, hopefully it did to you. Let us know your thoughts on it and what you have to take away.
Well, I mean, if you've got any other questions, could be engineering related to, I don't know, could be suspension or tyres or simulation or anything, then why not drop us a question? You can even leave us a 5-star podcast review. That'd be very nice. Alternatively, I guess you can get in touch with us on Twitter as well. So if you want to hear more of it, then let us know, and we can see what we can do.
Definitely, we could even insert a springle section, which is where we can just get these little pre-recorded bits from you, and you can tell us all about it. But like Dan just said, get in touch, let us know. Social medias were mentioned there. Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. The handle for all three of those is at TheNRF1. Also, you can get in touch with us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/NRF1. So on there, for signing up from as little as $2, you will get the full edition of this podcast, which will include our Of the Weekend Awards, the Norfolk Notebook, and the NRF1 Pit Stops. If you're listening to us in Patreon right now, those are coming up shortly. But you can also email us your ideas and questions. The email address is nrf1podcast@gmail.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Jake Humphrey here. You're listening to the best Formula One podcast from the best county in the world, the NRF1 podcast. And I wasn't paid any money to say that.
No, I did give you some beers.
Okay, now next we need to go on and have a quick preview of the next race, which is Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix, Imola, because it's too much of a mouthful. We need our native Italian here to Alex. We need him on to help us through this with the pronunciation.
Isn't it something like "and made by Pirelli" or something like this?
I've no idea. But it's Imola. I mean, we could go old school and call it the San Marino Grand Prix again, but I'll stick with Imola. Now, we had a good race there last year. It was nice to see a new circuit, and it's nice to see the circuit return. Now, guys, this is a big question. Who will be quicker, Red Bull or Mercedes? Who do you fancy?
I'm going to go for Red Bull again. Primarily because Mercedes it kind of looked like their weak point was combination braking and turning, which Imola is a bit of a git for. You do need to have that kind of good transient behaviour. So particularly if you're going down the hill towards, I can't remember what the corner names are, but the last couple of corners, you really need to be on it there. And we even saw Bottas, okay, he did have some damage, but he went off there last year, and that seemed to sort of cost him the race, really, didn't it? So I'm going to go for Red Bull again, partly that, and partly from, as I mentioned in my piece earlier on, you need to be really good over the curbs there. I know from a little bit of experience in sim racing, you really need to muller those curbs to get a proper good lap time. So, yeah, I think it's going to favour Red Bull. But it'll be interesting to see how Mercedes win this one.
Yeah, definitely. That'd be interesting. Phil, what about you? Do you agree with Dan, or do you think Mercedes will turn something around?
I don't think Mercedes can turn the time difference around that quickly for this track, to be honest. I think it will be Red Bull, just because I think they're the team. Although Max didn't win the race, he really should have done previous race, but they've definitely got a bit between themselves, and they seem to have more momentum into the weekends than the Mercedes did for the opening race. But I think it's going to be one hell of a battle again between two top drivers. Hopefully Sergio can get in and upset the apple cart a little bit and show some of his true pace, because he's got bags of it in there. So he just needs to step up and have a good Saturday. With a bit of luck, there'll be as a half an interesting race as the opener.
Yeah, hope so. I mean, the Imola circuit, we know is a quick one. I don't think it's the easiest in terms of overtaking, but like you say, hopefully we'll have another cracking race. And best of the rest, I guess we're kind of still almost hoping and expecting McLaren to be there.
Yeah.
No, I think, yeah, they're definitely going to be up there, aren't they? Because they've had the kind of free lap time from changing from Renault to Mercedes. And now that they got rid of the last chicane at Imola, it's kind of emphasised your straight line speed around Imola. So it kind of makes it a little bit more of a setup nightmare in that sense. It's not all high downforce. You need a bit of top speed as well. So. Yeah, McLaren should be up there. It's just a case of who's going to be with them.
No, that's very true. That's very true. It's going to be interesting to see who else is there, because that midfield is so compact. But hey, if it brings more good racing, then I think we're all happy.
Yeah. Well, we also have to mention the fact that Imola is kind of also one of those old school tracks. There's plenty of gravel around Imola that we don't necessarily have at Bahrain or even some of the newer Tilkodromes. So, as Bottas showed last year, and then with Verstappen's massive explosive puncture, kind of shows anything can happen, really. So if anyone at the kind of top end of the midfield, like your McLarens or your AlphaTauris, you could be on for a podium here.
That'd be something to keep an eye out for. Oh, on that note, then we're gonna bring in the predictions. Do you want to be bold enough to officially predict that we'll see someone else on the podium?
Yeah, okay. I'll say Danny Ric will get a podium, man.
Oh, I love it. Big shout, Phil. What about you? You got any predictions you wanna throw out there?
Yeah, I'm gonna have a prediction that I genuinely hope comes true for more than one weekend of this season. That Carlos Sainz outqualifies and outfinishes Charles.
Oh, I think he wasn't far off. To be fair, I think he's looked pretty good so far in the Ferrari. Sainz.
Yeah,
so.
He has. He has looked like he's made the move over to the Ferrari quite well and fitted into the car in the best way that he could do, coming from the McLaren, which was already a car as strong as the Ferrari. It's probably stronger this year, in all honesty. But he's got the experience to really, really get some good times out of that car, and that'd be great to see. Carlos go in there and push the Ferrari on a little bit, and hopefully secure the seat for the second year.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, hopefully Imola will be one to bring us some more fantastic racing. like we said earlier, more of the same, please. I don't think any of us were disheartened from that first race of the season, but I know we're delighted and we're looking forward to more. So I think that brings it to a good point where we can end. So it's time to say we will return with E277, which will be our review of Imola. And we're going to have plenty more following that, of course. We're really getting close to 300 now. I might even hit that before the end of the season, possibly right at the end of the season. We'll see. But yeah, it's going to have a lot of podcasts. But yeah, in the meantime, thank you, Phil and Dan, for joining me tonight.
No, thank you.
Thanks a lot for having us on.
No, really, really appreciate it. So yeah, thank you. And thank you, of course, everyone out there who's listening. I hope you enjoyed. I mentioned the social links earlier, so do get in touch and let us know your thoughts and ideas. But this has been the NRF1 podcast. We'll see you next time. Until then, goodbye.